Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Office of the President of Malta, entitled Events That Shook the Palace. This talk is delivered by Judge Giovanni Bonello.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Well, as the saying goes, here we are again. After a respite of about a year, we decided to carry on with the series, rediscovering the Grand Master's Palace. To be honest, at first I was met with some hesitation because some even told me, Salvatore, the subject has been exhausted. Why keep on the same subject? However, I was asked by the Office of the President to carry on a second series, and as you can see from the program, indeed, there is still much more to discover. To be honest, this evening we have Judge Giovanni Bonello, and at first also he was reluctant. But then, when he saw the subject, he said, okay, for you and for shaking the palace, I'll do it. And, well, we thank, of course, also the President. Unfortunately, he just told me that he is booked for every hour until the coming last day of March. As you know, all the lectures are normally held on the last Monday of every month, but the last one is going to be on the 17th of March. The subject, Preservation, it's most probably the President will tell me, I'm going to say it in Maltese, if it's Sasib Chahaja Mohbiya Matasanetla, are you going to find no hidden matters, hidden material in the palace once I am going to leave? But in any case, but then we'll see what's going to be. So I present you Dr. Hulu, is quite well known, and well, shaking the palace. I think it's to his liking, the subject per se. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Salvatore. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen and friends. Last time we met in this lovely hall, I talked about the deeds and the misdeeds of the Grand Masters, more misdeeds than deeds. Today, the subject is slightly less prurient than that. Today it is about the adventures and misadventures of the palace. But first we have to understand what the palace is. Today, we know about power, about rulers, about politicians, but we have to go back to the time of the knights, when this building was both the house of the Grand Master, the home of the Grand Master, and the seat of power. Today it's different. It's very rarely that the President or the Prime Minister live in their offices. While this was a place where the Grand Master slept, where he had breakfast, where he had his showers, where he entertained his friends, where he played cards, but it was also the place where he ruled the order. So we have to keep in mind that this place has both a private dimension and a public dimension. The name in itself is interesting. You will have noticed that in Malta we have many palaces. We have Palazzo Vergala, we have Spinola Palace, we have Palazzo Caraffa, we have a number of palaces. But there is only one palace. When you say the palace, without qualifying it, without adding some other adjective or some other description, it is the palace here, which can be called the Grand Master's Palace, the Governor's Palace, the President's Palace. Those are extras for me, and not for me only. This is the Mediterranean, Italian way of distinguishing one palace, which is the seat of power, and all the other palaces. So here we have the palace. Another thing which we have to keep in mind is that the Grand Master in this palace wore two different hats. This is something we tend to forget. From this palace, he ruled the Order of St. John. And that was one jurisdiction. But it happened that the Grand Master was not only the ruler of the Order of St. John, he was the Prince of Malta. So from here, he ruled Malta. These are two totally different functions, and it is wrong not to keep them distinct. And there are many misconceptions about this. The Grand Master was an autocrat. The Maltese had no say in the run. That's not true at all. The Maltese had no say at all in the running of the Order of St. John. If they did, it was only incidentally, because there were a couple of chancellors who were very powerful people who were Maltese. But that is exceptional. The Grand Master, in his function as ruler of the Order of Malta, was one thing. And that is what gets the limelight, because the big things were what the knights did. At least in official history, that was it. But the Grand Master was also the Prince of Malta. And he ruled Malta on a totally different level from the way he ruled the Order. The Order had its court. The Maltese had their courts. The Order had their audit. They had their treasury. And Malta had its order and it had its treasury. And one thing which is often forgotten is that in his function as ruler of Malta, the Grand Master relied very, very heavily on Maltese. All the judges, or virtually all the judges, were Maltese. All his ministers, were Maltese. All the heads of police were Maltese. All the people who ran the hospital services, the health services, were Maltese. This is important to keep in mind. We tend to see the Grand Master, profile him as only as the ruler of the Order of Malta. Please keep this distinction in mind, because it is very important to know when he was wearing the autocratic hat of Grand Master of the Order of Malta, and when, as a totally different persona, he was the ruler of the island of Malta. This palace, I've already said, had many functions. And this is relevant to what I'll be saying later on. One of the functions of the palace was the residence of the Grand Master. Another function of the palace was the seat of the government of the order. Another function was the seat of the government of Malta. Another function was that this place was the court in the sense of criminal court, of the Order of Malta, not of the Maltese. The Maltese had a different system of criminal jurisdiction. So in this palace, the great trials of impertinent knights were held in this palace here. It was also the symbol of power. So all the pageantry of the order, all the rituals of the order, happened in this place. That is by way of introduction, because I think that those are necessary preliminaries. But now I'll be doing what Salvatore told me to do. It will be rather disjointed, episodic, because we're talking of events. Events that somehow use the headline-grabbing word, rocked the palace. And I think the first dramatic, traumatic event in the palace here was in 1581, when a large number of knights, half the knights, rebelled against Grand Master Lacassière. The drama took place in this palace. This palace was incomplete, but I'll come back. It was totally different, or highly different from what it is today, but the conspiracy was hatched here and executed here. A conspiracy that wanted to get rid of Lacassière. Lacassière was very old. It is recorded that he had gone deaf, that he slept halfway through the council meetings, and the younger knights thought it was time that somebody took his place. It was basically a power struggle. He lived too long, and there were many impatient people who were itching to take his place. And these people, nominally led by one of the great heroes of the order, Romegas, Mathurin Lescaut, who was genuinely one of the most famous sea captains of the order. He was a legend throughout the Mediterranean. They chose him. He wasn't the principal conspirator. The principal conspirators were others. But they wanted a figurehead to make this rebellion more acceptable, to give it the dignity of a big, big name. And they twisted Romegas' arm to become the ringleader. It was a very messy affair. The Grand Master was arrested here in the palace and taken to virtual imprisonment in St. Angelo. One of the things that precipitated the rebellion was Lacassière was a rather strict disciplinarian. He had prohibited prostitutes from living in Valletta, and this had raised a huge wave of discontent amongst the younger knights. I don't have to explain why. And in fact, it is recorded, a very, very sad incident is recorded, that he was taken from the palace here to St. Angelo in a carriage under arrest, and all the way from here to the marina, he was jeered and virtually pelted by the prostitutes of Valletta. Thankfully, when he reached Birgu, he was welcomed by a number of ladies from Birgu, and ladies I mean without irony, who saw him as an old benefactor, who had always taken care of the poor, and they gave him a rather rousing welcome on the other side of the harbor. I won't tell you how the story ended. The story ended that the Pope intervened. He sent for the two ringleaders to go to Rome. They virtually both died brokenhearted in Rome. And that was what this revolt of the palace was about. Did it rock the palace? Yes, because the order was a monolithic structure where discipline and the vow of obedience to your superiors was supreme. It was one of the three characteristics of all the knights that they had to obey. And here they were, in open treachery, in open rebellion, in open treason against the Grand Master. So yes, that was one of the events that really profiled the history of this palace. Then there were minor things. For example, the thefts from the palace. You would think thefts from the palace, yes. There are recorded a number of rather important thefts from the palace. I have to keep in mind that the turretta here, the tower of the palace, was the strong room of the palace. Money was kept there, valuables were kept there, money was minted there. The first mint of the order was in the turret here, the first mint in Valletta, because before there were other mints. But the first mint in Valletta was in the turret of the palace. And I have three thefts which are recorded in the records. When I say in the records, I mean either records of the order or of the Inquisition, or in private diaries or in private papers, but they are recorded. For example, on the debt of Grand Master Del Monte, somebody helped himself to the solid gold salt and pepper cruets of the Grand Master's table. They disappeared. In the hullabaloo, in the excitement of the burial of the Grand Master, somebody stealthily managed to get hold of the gold, solid gold cruets that were graced the Grand Master's table. There's no trace of them after that. They disappeared. That was in 1572. In 1598, there was another shocking event. The King of Spain had sent 40,000 gold scudi to help the order in the fortifications of Gozo. The order has pleaded poverty. They said Gozo needs to be defended. We don't have the money to do it. And had asked the King of Spain to help. And the king had sent this nice bag full of gold coins which was stored in the Turretta. The Turretta also guarded all the loose jewels of the order, all the valuables of the order. And one day, these, or part of these, disappeared. There was no explanation to it until the Grand Marshal, the Marshal was the head of police. He was the one in charge of security, of internal security. The Marshal happened to visit a Sicilian blacksmith and saw a huge key there on the... And he got suspicious because normal keys were not that huge. And he confiscated the key and saw that it fitted exactly in the strong room of the palace. And, of course, this gave away this... The slave who had eyed the possibility of helping himself to this loot, and he was arrested. He confessed. Of course, he confessed after his hand was hacked off. So there was a gentle persuasion to make him confess, and the slave was hanged. But this was not the only theft from the Turretta. In 1668, a Greek who was in charge of the armory also had more or less the same ideas. He had, being in charge of the armory, he was an expert in the in metal molding and in metal work, and he falsified the keys to the Turretta. And slowly he started, not very ostentatiously, helping himself to jewelry, to gold, to coins, and he was given away by his lavish living. Suddenly, from being a rather a pauper who was working for his living, he started living big. And again, this raised suspicions. And he was apprehended. He confessed. Again, his hand was cut off. That was the normal punishment for thieves. It still is under the Sharia law, I believe. But at that time, we shared this belief that to make sure that his hands don't get greeted a second time, they just lopped off his hands. And finally, he was hanged. When the discovery was made, the order decided, in thanksgiving, to get hold of the nicest jewels that were in the Turretta, that were still there, and to do a wonderful monstrance for St. John, to have a blacksmith fashion these gems and these jewelry to be made into a monstrance of St. John. That was in thanksgiving for a theft. The monstrance was then stolen by Napoleon, so it was... If I can, with your permission, Salvo, I intended to limit myself to the palace here. But before the palace here, there was a palace in Bergu. The Grand Master's palace, before they came over to Valletta, was in Bergu. And there's a story which is really creepy, which happened at that. Did it shake the palace big way? Yes. The person, the candidate, after Domedes died, or in succession for Grand Master Domedes, was a very, very striking Italian nobleman, Fra Leone Strozzi, who was the utmost in ability and the pits in morality. He had already taken part in a couple of murders in Italy, but that's beside the point. And he thought he had the election to the Grand Mastership in his pocket. In fact, he was so cocksure that he didn't even come to Malta for the election. He relied on his reputation because he was a great soldier, a great statesman, a great politician, and he thought that that was enough. But he counted his chickens too early, and Grandmaster Lassengle beat him in the election by a couple of votes. Now, Leone Strozzi, on the face of it, was sporting. He congratulated the Grand Master and everything. But something very sinister happened. There were three knights who worked against him, who works against Strozzi, and swung the balance towards La Sangue, and these three knights were Fra Giovanni Antonio Pescatore, Fra Giorgio Vagnone, and Fra Bernardino Parpaglia. These three were the ringleaders of those who managed to cheat Strozzi of the Grand Mastership. And in a very short time, the three of them died in mysterious circumstances. The general view was that Strozzi had them poisoned. And this is not far-fetched, because Strozzi always ran around with the best poisoner in Italy. It was Biagio Pesci, who already had made a reputation for himself as a contact killer by poison in Florence, and he happened to be in the retinue of Leone Strozzi. And anyway, whatever it was, these three knights, leading knights, who had been instrumental to La Cassiere, to Sangle, La Sangle, being elected instead of Fra Leone Strozzi, they died within a very, very short period. But it's not the end of the story, because the brother of Bernardone Strozzi, Bernardone Parpaglia, Aleramo Parpaglia, who was also a knight of Malta, found Pesci at night in a dark alley and stabbed him to death. And that was the story of the non-election of Fra Leone Strozzi. Verdal, Grandmaster Verdal, faced another near revolt here. Verdal seems to have been a rather weak character, and he had a lot of discontents too. They accused him rather falsely to Rome of some ill-doings. The fact is that his grandmastership, although we see him as the glorious person in the Palazzo Verdala, he's the only grandmaster of Malta who became a cardinal, he had a very unhappy reign, because he was all the time torpedoed by the major knights in Malta. One author of the time says that, it's a nice phrase, that those who were unhappy with him were the progressives, but he doesn't call them progressives. He calls them inventori di novità. They were creators of newfangled ideas, and these were the ones who opposed Verdal. And he died, again in inverted commas, full of worries and internal resentments. Poor Verdal died, but he had a wonderful lying in state, and one of the functions of the palace was the lying in states, which were great pageants. The more we approach, is this very, I'm feeling it a bit blue. Yes, shall I put it a bit back? Are you hearing me at the back? Okay, so one of the functions of the palace was to organize the lying in state of grandmasters. Of course, externally everybody webbed them. Deep down, those who had ambitions to succeed them were perhaps slightly less sense of bereavement. But we notice, because we have very detailed descriptions of these lying in states, how with the advance of the Baroque period, I always distinguish the, and I'm not personal about it, the period of the order, the grandmasters who did not wear wigs and the grandmasters who wore wigs. And the opulence and the Baroque style is from Perellos onwards. Perellos was the very first grandmaster to wear a wig up to Hompesch. Before Perellos, no grandmaster wore a wig. And coincidentally or not, the grandmasters who wore wigs were the less pious and the more opulent, the more conscious of their public image. So the lying in states of the grandmasters gradually became from a very, very reserved, religious, contemplative occasion into a great pageant, a display of power. One thing that really changed the palace was, it's something that sounds banal today, but it wasn't at that time, the arrival of water in the palace. Valletta was a wonderful city, but it suffered from one great, great drawback. It had no water. When I say it had no water, it means that there was no running water. All the water depended on wells, which would, every house had an obligation to dig a well. It also depended on a daily supply of water from Marsa on barges. There were barges which came and went to Marsa. There was plentiful water, and the water was carried in barges daily from Marsa to Valletta. If something happened, Valletta was parched. Particularly in summer, when the wells dried up, it was a major thing. And good grandmaster, Alof de Vignacourt, was the first one to think big. He said, we have to solve the problem of the water. And mostly out of his own purse, he saw to this gigantic operation of the bringing of water all the way from Busquet, or the area of Busquet, to Valletta. It was a gigantic feat, not only financially, not only, but also engineering-wise, because the differences in level, to go only by gravity, the difference in level between Rabat and Valletta are not that large, and there were major, major engineering problems, which were solved eventually by Bontadino de Bontadini, who was, was a Bolognese engineer, water engineer, who came to Malta after three other engineers had failed, and one of them actually escaped from Malta in shame because his plans were disastrous. And Bontadino managed to get water all the way from Imdina, from Busquet to Valletta. And the first, obviously, to have running water was this palace here. The water came in the fountain out there on the exact date, 16th April 1615. That was a great day for Valletta. Finally, there was running water, which was a rather a supply that did not dry up. There was enough water for the whole city. First, it started the palace and the infirmary. Probably the infirmary got the water before the palace, but anyway, more or less at the same time. Then the auberges, then the convents, and then private houses. And eventually, this was a revolution. The fact that you open the tap, literally, there were taps in those times. There were taps, even in Pompeii, you can see taps which are virtually exactly like ours, except that they use lead pipes, which today we would not like to use because lead is known to be a rather major poison. But finally, this palace had its own water. On a more private scale, I can mention a couple of duels that were fought in the palace. There was one in 1605 where we don't know the circumstances, but it's safe to guess that it was about a girl, but the records do not say what they fought. But one very prominent knight of Malta, at that time was a young man, but eventually he had a wonderful career in the order. He became admiral of the order. Fra Giulio Carigi fought a duel in the entrance of the palace. The entrance wasn't this at the time. There was only one entrance, which was the one at the, more or less it wasn't that, but quite close to the Attorney General's office. And it is known that they fought a duel there on the Grand Master's doorstep. Fortunately, no one died, because many times these duels ended with one, or occasionally even both parties dead. But it was something that, of course, was extremely shocking. Contrarily to legends that the knights permitted duels, it's not true at all, that the knights had special places where duels could be fought, it's not true at all. The legislation of the order was extremely strict against duels. All these legends you read that Stretta was permitted to duel there, that the knights closed an eye about it, it's not true at all. Duels were prohibited, and when the survivor was caught, he and his seconds were very harshly dealt with. The second duel that happened in 1636 was more picturesque. It was a knight of Malta, Fra Prospero Colonna, and Colonna, you know, was the top Roman family. The Colonnas were really the big name in Rome. They had popes, they had princes, they had huge riches. They were probably the richest family in Rome. And Fra Prospero Colonna, one of the younger siblings of the Colonna, was a knight in Malta. And apparently he had, or his family had, a feud with the Cesarinis, which are also a big family in Rome, but not as big as the Colonnas. And one day, Prospero Colonna was leaving the palace, and on the doorstep of the palace, there was Fra Pietro Cesarini. And all the other knights, when they saw the Colonna, doffed their hats and saluted as befitted a Colonna, all except Cesarini. Cesarini kept his hat on, and that was a terrible insult, and it's enough to kill somebody if he keeps his hat on. And immediately, Colonna challenged him to a duel. There and then, he said, "Let's end this. Out with your sword, sir, and let's see. Let's have it out here." The exact words are recorded in the record. Thankfully, they both drew their swords, but there were a large number of knights who grabbed them and separated them, and so saved at least one life. But this, a duel which is strongly against the law, a Colonna and a Cesarini dueling on the Grand Master's threshold, was something that really was good food for gossip. The palace here was the place for big ceremonies. I won't go into them, there are hundreds of them. I should perhaps mention one particular one, because it was very strange. As far as I know, no reigning monarch ever visited Malta at the time of the knights. I am not aware that any monarch ever visited. But very high dignitaries did. And I would like to mention one very big dignitary, a Russian, Sheremetev, Prince Sheremetev. If you go to Moscow, you will land in Sheremetev Airport. And that is named after Prince Sheremetev, who came to Malta, was the first envoy of the Tsar of Russia to come to Malta. And he came in an official delegation to ostensibly to explore Malta, but he had an official function. He was an ambassador of the Tsar, and he kept a diary, or rather his secretary kept a diary. He was extremely impressed by Malta. How clean the streets were. I don't know whether he would say that today, but he said that's incredible that even gentlemen can walk with their shoes in the streets. You don't have to catch a coach. You don't have to go by sedan chair. You can actually walk in the streets. They are so perfectly clean. Sheremetev then described all the ceremonies here in the palace. There was a lot of formality. All the titles of the Tsar were read out. It took half an hour to read all his titles. Then presents were exchanged. But poor Sheremetev, it served him wrong, because when he went back to Russia, his enemies said that he had converted to Catholicism in Malta. And that was a great, great accusation, because he was Orthodox, and that was considered treason for a prince. He was a cousin and the most powerful man in Russia after the Tsar, and this clouded his reputation. Whether it's true or not, we don't know. He does write in great admiration of the functions, of the religious functions which he saw at St. John's, and of the other religious functions he attended. For example, he censors in his memoirs the fact that he knelt in front of the Grand Master. We know that from the Maltese records, that he knelt in front of the Grand Master. That was 1698, Sheremetev. His visit was 1698. And, of course, it would have sounded very bad had he said that he knelt down in front of the Grand Master. That is inked out of his memoirs. And eventually, he was never in total disgrace, but he was always under a cloud. And like Prince Sheremetev, we have very detailed accounts of the papal legates' visits, because in the early 18th century, the Pope started giving Catholic monarchs in Europe, only to Catholic monarchs, the Stocco and Pileo, which was a ceremonial hat, a huge ceremonial helmet, and a beautiful sword, a decorative sword. And these were handed to every Catholic sovereign in Europe. In other places, this was taken in their stride. But in Malta, huge festivities were organized every time the Grand Master received the Stocco and Pileo. And all these were organized, these big festivities. We mean fireworks, we mean exchange of gifts, running into huge gold crosses, diamonds, emeralds, were made in exchange for the obbligato, it was called. It was a special envoy from the Pope who came to the palace and gave these presents and this honor to the Pope. Sadly, not even one of these hats and swords remains in the palace. There is one set. There should be about six, because as far as I could ascertain, Villena was the first one to receive it, and all the Grand Masters after Villena received this beautiful hat. It was velvet, embroidered with gold and silver and pearls, and a sword, a ceremonial sword, which a jewel sword. And they don't exist anymore. But thankfully, the order in Rome still has the set, one set of them. And I think there is another set in France, but the others have disappeared. One thing that really changed: the palace is the year 1741. Up to 1741, the palace was nothing like we know it today. I don't want to go into the details of the history of the palace, but the palace had started as five or six different houses belonging to five or six different people, with different facades, with different entrances, with different staircases. It was a mess. If you see what the palace looked like before 1741, it was just this block of buildings, but containing at least six different independent buildings, which the Grand Masters, starting from the corner, the first residence of the Grand Master was the Attorney General's office, and then he bought the house next door, and then another Grand Master bought the house next door, and then the other Grand Master bought the house behind, and eventually they were incorporated. But they were incorporated internally. There were passages, doors opened internally, new staircases built. But the facade was never unified. It was Grand Master Pinto in 1741 who decided that it was time for the facade to be rebuilt. And he unified this mess of architectural styles and of different facades into one unified facade. I haven't been able to establish yet whether he pulled down the old facades and rebuilt them or only faced them. That is something that will have to be established later. I believe he pulled down the facade. It's not only a facing, but a whole rebuilding of the facades. And finally, the facade of the palace got some unity. It wasn't like that before. And today, although if you examine it carefully, you see doors open and doors closed, you see windows which are not symmetrical, you see windows which are false windows, just to give the idea. But all in all, today, the palace is one unity. Architecturally, at least on the external part, it is unified. And that is due to Grand Master Pinto and to an architect we don't know who. Unfortunately, there are these lacune. Who the architect was is very doubtful. My own personal guess, but it is pure speculation, based only on stylistic similarities, it is Belli, the architect Belli. And he was the architect, the more famous architect of the time. He was, his brother was the Grand Master Pinto's chief advisor, so it is natural to assume he was a very talented architect. So it is safe to assume that this 1741 revolution of the palace is due to architect Belli. One of the events that really rocked the palace was the revolt of the slaves. This was something very, very serious. And it rocked the palace physically, and I will tell you why. No, I'm wrong. This is the revolt of the slaves of 1749. Normally, the slaves were the slaves and the knights were the knights, but the evidence is that they were not treated that badly. They were deprived of their liberty. They were made to do menial work. But, of course, every chance they had to escape from Malta, they took. But a full-blown rebellion of the slaves, which contemplated the assassination of the Grand Master and of all the chief, seriously, this is not fables, had never happened before. In 1749, the governor of Rhodes, Mustafa Pasha, had been captured by the knights, had been captured incidentally, but he was in Malta. He was given very good treatment. He was given a palace in Floriana where he could live in luxury. He was provided with servants, with food, with whatever he wanted. But he was a very ambitious person, and he decided that the weakness of the order was that there were too many slaves who were not loyal to the order, but loyal to the Ottoman rule, that he could manipulate. And he organized a very, very detailed revolt of the slaves. The revolt had to happen on the day of Imnaria, when most of the Maltese would have been out of Malta, and most of the people would have been out of Valletta, sorry, and most of the soldiers would have been on holiday, and most of the security services would have been a bit on the lax side, because it was the great festival. And the idea was to have this revolt planned to the last detail. And Insaleti, who was the Grand Master's personal valet, and to all intents and purposes, a friend of the Grand Master, he was to be the leader of the revolt inside the palace. He was the valet of the Grand Master. The idea was to let Pinto go to sleep, and six slaves, including Minceletti, had to rush his bedroom, cut his head off with a poisoned sword, and come to the window and show the Pinto's head from the palace balcony. And that was the signal for all the revolt of the slaves. This is very well documented. This is not fantasy. This is really the truth. Eventually, two slaves who were in the revolt, three rather, got rather drunk in a tavern and started blabbing about what they were going to do. And they were overheard by a Jew, Cohen, who took note of the details. He was hearing these drunks, and came at night on that day to wake up Pinto and inform him what was going on. And, of course, this revolt aborted. They were all arrested, all horribly tortured, and virtually all executed. It was one of the most gory pages in the history of the order. The details of the torture and the torments these slaves were so blood-curdling that a book that described them in detail was prohibited in Europe. It was put on the index of prohibited books so that Europe would not know the extent of the barbarity with which this rebellion had been set down. The other uprising was the Mannarino uprising. It was nothing as serious as the revolt of the slaves. In 1775, this rather deluded priest, Don Gaetano Mannarino, organized a rebellion, and he thought that the Maltese would rise and support him. His plan was to capture St. Telmo and St. John's Cavalier, and once those were secured in their hands, give the signal, and all the Maltese would rise in sympathy. In fact, they did capture St. John's Cavalier. In fact, they did capture St. Telmo. But there was no response. The the Maltese just did ignore them. And so the revolt rather fizzled out. I've chosen this because it raised great consternation in the order. The knights didn't really know whether the Maltese would respond or not. So there was a bit of panic here in the palace, not knowing how to deal with it. The Grand Master sent for the bishop and said, look, he's a priest, take care of him, try to calm him down, bring him back to reason. And it was agreed that the few rebellious, there were 30, 40 in all, would surrender and they would be pardoned. If they surrendered, they would be pardoned. What happened was that after this was agreed, somebody at St. Elmo fired a gun and the cannonball landed in the palace. They say that it's still visible where the cannonball landed here. I've never managed to trace it, but you find in historians that this cannonball, the damage that it did was not, or rather is visible to this day. So the Grand Master in council being cannonballed by a priest, they did not like it. And they said this is a good reason to renege on the agreement. They were all arrested, some of them were hanged, some of them were quartered, and some of them were imprisoned for life. Mannarino was imprisoned for life. The story why he wasn't hanged is not a very pretty one. He betrayed all his compatriots. He betrayed all the other conspirators. He made a secret confession to the Grand Master, not under torture. He volunteered. He exposed all the other conspirators. And he went to the extent of sending a second secret memorandum to the Grand Master. He said, look here, I forgot those two by those three. And here are their names. Those were treacherous. Those were in the conspiracy with me. Today we honor Don Gaetano Mannarino as one of the national heroes. I have my doubts. Another event that physically shook the palace was, it was during de Rohan's time. Grandmaster de Rohan was like all the princes of Europe, an enlightened prince, and at that time, it was considered to be very avant-garde to have an astronomical observatory. Malta did not have an astronomical observatory, and de Rohan thought that this was something he had to put right. And so he bought state-of-the-art instruments, astronomical instruments, installed them in the Turretta, and got one of the very leading astronomers in Europe to man the Turretta here, Dangos. Dangos was a leading, but he cheated. He published false findings. He said he had discovered comets and discovered, which was all fantasy. And he was discredited completely. But that is not the point. One of the last things that happened was that the Turretta caught fire. And the Turretta caught fire, there are varying reports. One says it was hit by lightning. And the other story says that the Turretta was caught fire because Dangos was experimenting with sulfur and it went out of hand and the Turretta was ablaze. And all the instruments were lost. The Grand Master, who had not yet suffered the loss of the French revenues, bought again all the instrumentation. He bought a second set of instruments for the Turretta. Dangos eventually skulked out of Malta because he had been dishonored throughout Europe. Unfortunately, when Napoleon came, somebody hid all these very precious instruments. These instruments were handmade and extremely expensive. They were all the best instruments available in Europe and extremely expensive. They were buried in between two false ceilings in the Turretta. An English officer discovered them and they disappeared. So maybe we can close now with one of the most dramatic incidents that happened in the palace, the arrival of Napoleon. Although there were good reasons to believe that the order was prepared for the arrival of Napoleon, they were in denial, or rather Hontes, was in denial. He didn't believe that this would happen, and so when it happened, the order was terribly unprepared. When the French Navy, huge French Navy, it said that it covered the whole horizon, it blackened the whole horizon. When the French fleet arrived, huge panic. There were the usual, those who wanted to resist, those who wanted to parley, and those who wanted to surrender. And the poor and decisive Hompesh wasn't a bad bloke, but he didn't have the genes of Grandmaster de Valette. He was totally lost. He was in depression. He didn't want to talk to people. And people were shouting at him, surrender, let's fight, surrender, let's fight. The Maltese notables met across the road in Sinwa, what today is the what we call the Sinwa, the palace, the Banca Giuratale. There was a lot of excitement there too, but the Maltese notables were more united than the knights. Surrender. And seeing that the Grand Master was differing whether to surrender or not, they came into the delegation, they stormed into this room where the council was being held 24 hours a day. They stormed in there, and rather impolitely, but the moment didn't call for good manners, they started shouting that they had the order had to surrender to Napoleon, to his mercy. Of course, there was the knights who had more of a backbone were terribly offended by these Maltese things here, coming in here and dictating to the Grand Master what to do. And some of them said, treason, arrest them right away. Treason, this is treason against the order. It's treason against the sovereignty of the order. And they wanted them arrested. But of course, Hompesh did nothing one way or the other. We know how that ended. And that was the last event where the poor Grand Master walked out, humbled, almost a prisoner, to go to his exile. After that, the palace in the French period and in the British period went through a lot of other interesting times. But Salvatore told me to stop at the Grand Master's. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Office of the President of Malta, entitled Events That Shook the Palace. This talk was delivered by Judge Giovanni Bonello.